Les colloques du Collège de France.
So we'll start the final leg of today. We have two speakers talking about education and the brain. And I'm very happy to welcome first Elisabeth Spelker. Liz is the Marshall Berkman Professor of Psychology at Harvard, where she's been a faculty member since 2001, and she's the Director of the Laboratory for Developmental Studies. We met in 1998, I believe, for the first time, maybe before Jack Place, but yeah. We met seriously to talk about real work together in 1998 in Lyon. It was very interesting story. We were both working on almost exactly the same task because we cared about approximate versus exact number. And we realized when we met in Lyon that we were running almost exactly the same task. You were doing behavioral work with bilinguals and I was doing imaging work in the lab. And the tasks were so similar that we decided to publish them together in one paper, which was the Science 1999 paper on approximate versus exact number. I think this illustrates the kind of mental convergence that we had even before really working together. We really were thinking in very similar ways, and this was just the start of a huge number of experiments that we co-designed at home, in the lab, with Pierre Picard, with Véronique Izard. So I don't want to be much longer, but thank you, Liz, for really decades of collaboration. Thank you. I guess the title is not Happy Birthday, Stan. The title is Educability.
Educability, yes. Thanks. Okay, but let me start with my most important slide, which is a thank you to you, Stan. As you said, we go back a long way. We go back into the 90s. I didn't risk a more specific date than that. But I want to correct one thing that you just said in your introduction. You said, we decided to do this and we decided to do that. But that's not actually what happened. What happened in this case was I had been at MIT for a little while and loved interacting with Nancy Kanwisher. We even collaborated on some behavioral studies. But in a million years, it never occurred to me that one could, and back in those days, it was actually quite rare for this to happen, one could publish a single paper that had a behavioral experiment in it that was done in one lab and a neuroimaging experiment in it that was done in another lab. And it raised for me all kinds of doubts, like, who do you get to review this? And if they're a neural person, how are they going to evaluate the behavioral work and vice versa, right? But you were the person who said, oh no, this is going to work. And as you just mentioned in, yeah, I guess 1999, it did come out in Science, but that was all your idea and your determination and what I felt like. Huge gratitude for bringing me along on the ride, but there's no way that I would have generated that idea. But you didn't stop there, and our collaboration didn't stop there. We turned to geometry, and you had what I thought was an even crazier idea, which is that we take a very complicated, hard psychophysical task and present it to totally uneducated people in the Amazonian jungle, presented by experimenters who we had no direct contact with, Munduruku speakers. And I thought, there's no way in the world that this is going to work. But once again, this was your idea, and you believed in it, and you turned out to be right. What I put here below the tasks themselves are data that on one of the two axes, I can't read which one, but one of them is showing the results that Véronique Izard and I collected in my lab on Harvard students, and the other is showing the minimally educated Munduruku. And you can see that item by item, the performance is really quite similar. So a second time in a row, you were right. This is getting annoying, but there's a third, okay? Which is when you took this turn toward leveraging insights from cognitive science to improve education. And I thought, poor Stan, that is a hopeless task, right? It's hopeless in so many different ways. First of all, for centuries, people have been writing about and thinking about how should we educate the young. And there was no consensus, no coalescence around a set of kind of uniform principles that everybody agreed to that would make for the best education. And what's more, there's a lot of intuitive resistance to the path that you argued for, which is an evidence-based approach, evidence-based in two senses. One, based on evidence from results we already have from laboratory experiments, but two, based on evidence from experiments run in classrooms. And that can raise tremendous resistance from teachers, from parents who worry that you're using their child as a guinea pig. But you assembled an amazing team working with the French Ministry of Education as the director of their scientific advisory board to put some just very, very valuable enterprises in motion, including another often unpopular move, which is to actually systematically test all the children in France to see what they know and what they don't know. This can raise a lot of worries about, parents once and teachers, once they know how a child did, this is going to bias their perceptions of the child. But you argued, I think, correctly and persuasively that it's in the best interests of the children and the best interests of the education system to have good data on what's working and what isn't, and as a basis for evaluating interventions that can make things work better. So that was all your work, and I mean, you started that advisory board. You brought people like me on board, right? But that's all you did. You brought me on board. It wasn't my vision. It wasn't our vision. It was yours, and it's just totally amazing. So thank you for all of that. Really, bravo. Okay, well, after that, what I'm going to do in this talk is really pretty minimal and humbling. First of all, I don't deserve any credit for the title. I stole it from Les Valiant, a computer scientist at Harvard, who wrote this really interesting book on the importance of being what he calls educable, and discovered I really liked both his ideas and also the concept itself. So what I want to talk about today is I want to tell you about some new, unvetted, unpublished, in need of replication findings from my lab, research findings from my lab, which I'll argue support two suggestions, nothing more than that, not firm conclusions, but two suggestions, first of all, about how children learn new number concepts at home, and second, how children learn math in school. And in both of these cases, I decided to take this sort of unusual approach. By the way, I've really appreciated all the talks that came before this one that took a much more integrative approach and showed us these gorgeous lines of research over years, converging on a deep understanding of how the brain is performing in different contexts and how the human mind is forming and using concepts. I think that's just great work to have done, but it's not what I'm going to do now. It's late in the day. Maybe that'll be my excuse. I want to talk about some very new findings, and the reason I've chosen them is I think they give some support, Stan, to some of the things you've been working on recently, including your work on how exact large numbers are represented in adult brains, and your work on education as well. Okay, so let me start where I began in thinking about children's learning, which was in doing work on and thinking about what children don't need to learn because they already know it as early as you can test them. Research on infants and toddlers and young children provided evidence, I believe, that infants are endowed with at least six domain-specific cognitive systems, what I call systems of core knowledge, that center on abstract concepts that are applicable to all environments, concepts like causality in the work that Nancy Kanwisher talked about this morning on agents causing changes in objects or objects causing changes in the movements of other objects in the physics system. These systems also solve different problems, and they do so using distinctive limits. So the place system, for example, solves the problem of how you choose a path to get yourself from where you are now to a location that you want to go to. And some of its limits are that it's focused first and foremost on the geometry of the environment, not on other properties of the environment. And when you take such problems and limits and put them together, you end up with a set of signatures that allow you to ask some more questions. So one question is, are these abilities that we see unique to humans, or are they shared by other animals? And in the case of all these core knowledge systems, I think the answer is none of them are unique to humans. They're all shared by diverse other animals, not only other primates, as in the work that Andreas talked about, but also in birds and fish and other animals. You can also take these limits, though, and you can ask, what happens to these systems as kids get older? Are they scaffolding? Do they get kicked away and children start going beyond them and reasoning about the world using other kinds of concepts? Or do they remain present and functional in us throughout our lives? And they're testing for the signatures of each of these systems in children and in adults revealed that they're shared. They don't go away over development. Also opens up new avenues for probing their properties. So you can do studies in adults to probe whether these systems are operating under conscious awareness and control, or whether they're automatic and unconscious, and finding the latter. And you can also ask, what work are these systems doing for children? And the answer there seems to be that they're guiding children's reasoning and learning, including in school. But there's a problem with this whole story. The problem is that there are two core systems that capture numerical information, as Andreas said in his talk. One is a system that's really for representing objects, as Nancy talked about at the beginning of the day today. Because objects interact with each other on contact, to represent objects, you have to be able to represent more than one object at the same time within a scene. And that's where arises the possibility that you could use these object representations to develop number concepts like one and two and three, based on the representations of the number of objects that you're viewing in parallel. And this system supports, I think, mastery of the exact meanings of the words one, two, and three, as well as allowing for their tracking. Now, the other system supports numerical comparison and arithmetic, as Andreas told us, but therein raises the problem. Neither of these systems captures the integer concepts of primary school mathematics. The problem with the first system is that it stops at three, but the number concepts we use in mathematics don't actually stop at all. The problem with the other system is that it's not exact, and our large number concepts are. So that raises the question, how do children develop the integer concepts that are going to figure in their primary school curricula? So there are, I want to focus on two candidate answers to that question. The first answer comes from Susan Carey, and the general thrust of the answer is that exact number concepts, once you get beyond three, are not products of core knowledge. They don't come naturally based on solely on our cognitive nature as humans. They're products of culture, and they depend on culture-specific routines, especially counting routines. Now, I've argued, and Stan has argued, that there are problems with this account. One problem is that counting is actually a really weird thing to do. When adults and children communicate with one another, they often point to objects. And as they point to an object, they'll say something informative about it, like, look, that's a blackbird on the tree, or look, our dog just got into the refrigerator, or something like that, right? But when you're counting, you have a set of objects in front of you, and as you point to each one and say a word, the words you say say are not providing information about that object. The first object that you point to and say one, the object itself is not one. It is a member of the set, and what you're actually focused on by doing the counting is enumerating the entities in the set. But that's in no way obvious from the activities that you're performing as you're going through the counting routine. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that Carrie argues that the way that children come to understand or construct natural number concepts is they discover the analogy between the relative positions of the words in the counting list, like that four comes invariably after three and before five, and the numerical magnitudes that those words are picking out, what she calls the later greater rule. But here there's a second problem, which is that we're actually very good at memorizing sequences of words, for example, the lyrics to songs and so forth, or poems. But when we do so, we by no means get immediate access to the ordinal positions of those words. So if you think about a song that you know well and just pick a word at random and ask yourself, where does this appear in the song? I'm going to bet that in order to answer that question, you're going to have to recite the words again, counting them as you do it. But if that's true, then it doesn't seem like you could use ordinal position to learn what counting is about in the first place. So a different solution to the question how kids come to represent large exact numbers comes, I think, from Stan and his collaborators, especially Matthias Sablemeyer and Lorenzo Ciccone, in a paper that they've written very recently about exact number concepts in adults. And they argue that we represent exact large numbers our exact large number representations stem from a compositional system. We compose these representations of large numbers from smaller numbers, and we do so in a way that favors compositions that are maximally economical and minimum in their length. And they have beautiful examples from word frequency tables of number word frequencies in all different sorts of languages. I particularly like the one that points out that although we tend to find large numbers to be inversely related to their frequency, so the most frequent words will be smaller numbers, not larger numbers. When we have to represent the small differences, like between 24 and 26, we see a big difference in frequency that comes not from differences in their numerical magnitude, but from the fact that 24 can be represented a whole bunch of different ways because it has a whole bunch of factors that can be combined to produce it. The first not ready for primetime result that I want to share with you today comes from an experiment that we recently completed, just a single experiment, that we recently completed on three-year-old children who are learning the meanings of their first large number words like five. And the question is, after learning the exact meanings of one to three, will these children spontaneously, will they combine these numbers to figure out the meaning of the word five? So this was a training experiment. It was conducted by a wonderful graduate student at Harvard, Lucia Vilches. It involved 92 children, approximately 3 to 4 years of age, and was conducted by video conference. This all started during the days of the pandemic. And it began with a pretest that was used to determine for each child what number concepts they already had by using number words and tasking them with picking out the appropriate set of objects that word corresponded to using a pointing task. So the child is sitting with a parent in view. They see an array of four plates of different colors. They ask which plate has three candies. Can you point to that plate? The parent can see what the child is pointing to. We can't, and they give the
color of the plate that the child had pointed to. So that gives us a measure, as it's done with successively larger numbers, when you see how far children can go, it gives us a measure of their number word knowledge, which allowed us to set up an experiment for all of the children that used these small number words to see whether we could get them to learn exact representations for five or six. So we had two training conditions. Here was one of them. They see an array like the one you see here, and they're told by the experimenter, I have five berries, three blackberries, and two raspberries. And then, because we wanted them to respond to five and not to, oh, three, and also two, we took away the distinctive coloring, took away the spatial grouping, put them all together and said, here's my drawing of my five berries. I didn't have any colored pencils, so they all look the same. And then asked at the end of each training trial, can you now pick out which of these shows my five berries? Okay. So that was training in the compositional condition. The training in the control condition was a bit like counting, although it didn't involve any number words except the word five. It was, I have five berries, and then successively pointing to each of the berries in the display and saying, here's a berry, here's another, here's another, here's another, and here's another. And I just misspoke. We didn't actually use pointing because this was on Zoom. What happened is that as Lucia said, here's a berry, the first berry jiggled, and then the second berry jiggled, and so forth, as she was speaking along, okay? And for the case of the two blackberries and the three blackberries and the two raspberries, the three berries jiggled together and then the two jiggled together to draw the kids' attention to the subsets. And after getting either the compositional training or the control training, there was a post-test, which again involved the pointing test with the objects arrayed in three lines. And across the whole training session, there were actually three training blocks with different kinds of objects. A second kind, like the berries, involved objects that all had the same shape but different colors, and a third kind involving dogs and cats had objects that differed in shape, but otherwise the training results were the same. Now, the results of this experiment, I told you this is all going to be preliminary, were exceedingly disappointing, okay? We looked across the whole sample of children, and we found no effect of training condition on children's learning the meaning of five or six, okay? It was completely non-significant. So the compositional hypothesis fails for this group of children as a whole, okay? But Lucia wanted to go a step further and ask, suppose we look at the data separately for children depending on which number words they know, okay? And here's what the data look like when you do that. If you didn't know any number words initially, and I should say that at the outset, in order to be in this study, children had to be able to recite the count list. So they had to be able to go, you know, show an array of things, go one, two, three, four, five. So they all recognized the sounds of the words. But there were some kids who didn't reliably point to a set with one member over an empty set when asked for one. That would be a no-knower. And similarly, there were children who could give you one but not two, or two but not three, or three but not four, and so forth, okay? Now, if you look at this graph, you first see something that we should have known we were going to see from the outset, which is if you test it out as a four-knower or a five-knower, four-knower is less clear, as a five-knower or as a six-knower, of course you were not going to benefit from our training because you already were able to reliably pick out five versus six when, you know, at the very beginning of the experiment, right? So the training was not going to be useful for them. But more interesting, I think, is that the training was not useful for the no-knowers, the one-knowers, or the two-knowers either. It was only useful for the kids who knew the meanings of the words two and three. If they knew those meanings, then they were able to compose them to pick out a set of five, even from an array that had no spatial structuring to it and no qualitative differences between the items in the two sets. So I think what this suggests, emphasis on suggests, is that a language of thought thought for number, emerges early in childhood, and it supports the development of large number concepts. This is not to say that counting isn't important as a useful routine for reliably getting to exact sets, especially when they become larger than five or six. But it does say, I think, that there's an alternative path to numerical concept development for a child who has a compositional mind, who can take the concepts it begins with and combine them together to form new concepts. So that's the first half of my talk. And I think this will probably be a pretty short talk as a result. Is that true? Well, we'll see. We'll see. Actually, I'm not known for giving short talks, so maybe it won't be. So let me turn to the second topic. Learning math in school, okay? Now, I started the first topic by saying learning number words kind of presented a problem for me, thinking that all knowledge is being built from core knowledge, since there wasn't any obvious way that you could get to five if you only had the core concepts. There's another problem for me posed by a host of phenomena probing the conditions under which children do and do not learn math in school. First of all, preschool children from birth to about 6 years of age when they start school, they are terrifically good cultural learners. First of all, in infancy, they learn who's in their immediate social world. My favorite research here was done by Ashley Thomas and Rebecca Sachs, where Ashley videotaped a child's parents and presented the parent apparently in interaction with each of two puppets. Actually, the puppets were added to the video later, so the parent wasn't aware that this was going to happen. And as she looks at each of the puppets speak, and she speaks back the words spoken by one of the two puppets, but speaks a different word to the other one. This method was based on earlier findings that infants take imitation by one character, one social character of another social character, as a cue to the existence of a social relationship between those two characters. So the idea was that infants might think that mom was more socially connected to the puppet that she had imitated than to the other puppet. But to see whether that was the case, Ashley then tested children with just the two puppets present, both moving their mouths and calling to the baby by the baby's name. And in fact, babies tended to look at the puppet that their mother had imitated in support of the idea that they were learning who is a member of their social world. But from that, the next step is that by observing people who've been demonstrated to be a member of their social world and inferring their intentions, children learn all sorts of things. They learn the language that or languages that are spoken in the house by members of their social world. They learn all kinds of actions that are really hard to perform and that if you get them wrong could hurt you, right? Like learning to walk. I think it's an absolute miracle that children learn to walk over the first year or two of life. Nobody instructs them, just like nobody instructs them in learning their language. As they get up and start to totter along, they're very likely to fall over. But they seem to be tremendously intrinsically motivated to observe what the people around them are doing and then to attempt to reproduce those actions themselves, whether what they're doing is talking or walking or engaging in other activities, manipulating particular objects and so forth. And in this way, I think children learn all sorts of culture-specific object categories and functions and all sorts of cultural phenomena like singing and belief systems and values and so forth, all with little to no instruction. Okay, so stepping back from that and getting to the back to the topic of mathematics, it looks like there's at least four cognitive systems, early emerging unlearned cognitive systems, that should be supporting children's math learning before school, and it should support their learning of math in school as well. The two systems of number that I talked about before and that Andreas talked about, and also two systems of geometry, one for supporting learning to navigate through your geographical environment, and the other supporting learning to recognize and categorize objects by their forms. But this account faces at least three problems, okay? The account that you have these four systems, you're going to learn math. First, Many first-generation school children don't learn the math that's taught in their schools. This is particularly clear from beautiful data that's been collected in India, where almost all poor children, way more than 90%, are enrolled in school, and on any given day, most of them are attending school. Okay, they're going to school regularly. But nevertheless, they're at high risk of failing to learn the math that's being taught in their classrooms. And we know this because of a wonderful test that's been conducted on children all over India, where they're presented with a simple card and then by a person who has learned from the school records what grade they are in now. And if, for example, they encounter a child who is currently in third grade, they draw their attention to the third column here, which presents problems that whose solutions were taught in second grade. So the question is that the child is asked, see these four problems, pick two of them and solve them, or eight problems, pick two of them and solve them. If the child solves them correctly, then they go to the right and are presented with a problem from a higher grade level. If they can't solve either problem, then the next question comes from the left, where they go to a lower grade level. And in this way, each child's mastery of the math curriculum is assessed. And when you look across the data from the 700,000 children who received this test in 2022, which is the most recent one that's available on the web right now, what you see is that only about 25% of kids can do either subtraction and division or just two-digit subtraction with remainder, okay? About 1 in 4 kids can do that. You also see that in grade 5, only about 1 of 4 kids can do the long division problems that were taught in grade 4, okay? So that's the evidence that they're not learning, they haven't mastered the previous year's school curriculum. So problem one for me is, if all kids have core knowledge of number and geometry, why aren't they learning math in school? Okay, here's problem two. It comes from a study published recently on children who work in family markets and who sell to customers in those markets. And what the study shows is that kids who sell in family markets in India, these kids are in an especially interesting position because they may sell in the market in the morning, but their schools run in half-day sessions, so they can be in the market selling in the morning and they can go to school in the afternoon, okay? And most of these kids, I think the average was in seventh grade. So when they're selling in the morning, they're using math adeptly, doing calculations almost entirely in their heads, getting numbers right with high accuracy, sometimes errors on the very first try, but by the second try, they're getting them correct. But they fail the ASSER test. You give them the same ASSER test, and they look at it and say, oh, no, I can't do that. All right. So it looks like they can't solve the much simpler problems that were being taught in their school. The problems they had to solve in the market involved selling things with multiple different prices in different quantities and combinations and getting too much money and having to calculate what the change was going to be. And the kids were doing all that in their heads, but they couldn't do a simple, basically, single piece of those problems when presented as they're taught in school. So that's my second problem. Here's my third one. It comes from a study that Pauline Martineau and Stan and others have been involved in, using data from all of the children in France whose math skills were evaluated over the course of a few years. What that study showed was that at the start of school, when kids are evaluated before their math instruction has begun, boys and girls are about equally adept at mathematics, right? They're about equally knowledgeable and able to solve the problems in mathematics. The boys have slightly more variability than the girls. The boys are in blue here and the girls in red. But they're at about the same level of performance. But as soon as math instruction begins, the boys start to pull ahead. And as math instruction increases and they're tested at later point, children are tested at later points in time, the gender gap widens, okay? So that raises a question, why are the girls doing less well? And what might foster their learning of school math? Now, we know that the girls are not doing less well on tests of core knowledge. If they were, then we'd have a solution to, you know, a reason to think that these should be related to each other, but they're not. So why is it that they're doing less well at learning in school? Now, here I need to give a caveat. These are observational studies, so they don't directly get at causes or remedies. So in particular, the ASSER data tells us that many children fail to learn math, but it doesn't tell us why. The market data show us that many of them fail to use their math skills in school, but it doesn't tell us how to remedy that. And the rich data on that led to the discovery of this sex difference in math learning in French elementary school children, it showed that it's linked in some way to math instruction, but it doesn't tell us what changes to math instruction might mitigate it, okay? Now, that's not to say that observational studies are useless. They can actually be very useful at eliminating some hypotheses, and I'll just give a couple examples of that. Back in 2005, I debated Steve Pinker on the reasons for sex differences in math and science in adults, but often, you know, relying on data from studies of children. And Steve argued that the reason that there's more men in science and in other mathematically intensive academic fields is that males have greater intrinsic aptitude for math, you know, more talent, more motivation. And then I had moved to Harvard by that point, and my president, Larry Summers, quoted Pinker as, this is the reason why we don't have more women in our math department and other departments like that. But the thing is that when you look at the data coming out of France, that when we looked at the data at the time that was coming out of labs, we knew that if there were differences in intrinsic, sex-linked genes, then you might think that even preschool boys would outperform preschool girls on tests of core knowledge in domains of number and geometry, and they don't. But we also knew, now know from the study that was conducted in France on the gender gap in math learning, that the boys and girls scored equally when they first entered school. So again, there's really no evidence there for some intrinsic difference causing this. Now, that says that they ruled out one of Steve's key arguments, but the data from France also ruled out one of my key arguments. I argued that the sex differences were likely products of culture, and it was the parents who were treating their sons and their daughters differently. But that, too, seems to be a non-starter, given the finding that when kids first get to school, after all of those years of parenting in the home, there's no sex differences there right at the beginning. A final thing that I think is these data cast doubt on is the idea that boys may be more interested in all kinds of combinatorial symbol systems. But if that were true, they'd be better readers than girls. And as far as I know, that's not the case. Am I right? I'm out of time. Oh, don't tell me I'm out of time. Okay, I'm almost done. So we don't know what the answers to the cause of the gender gap is or how to change it, but I do think it's a good bet that randomized experiments in schools could provide better ways to do it and to close gender gaps. And I want to just mention one question that I think could be answered in that way, and then give you my last piece of data recently collected and in need of more analysis that I think might speak to this in some way. The question is, are girls doing less well than boys because of the content in the math curriculum, the math content, or are they doing less well because of the ways in which math instruction is proceeding, okay? And what I think may bear on that is the results of an educational math intervention that Molly Dillon and Josh Dean, Esther Duflo, and our wonderful colleagues in India has conducted over the last few years. We developed math games to be used in Indian, first to be used in Indian preschools and evaluated them by randomizing kids to four conditions. In one condition, kids played purely intuitive math games using symbols that make sense to infants and to monkeys, I believe, from Andreas's talk. Another condition used purely symbolic material, presenting the same quantities but in the form of symbols. And then there was a third condition that presented half of the intuitive games and half of the symbolic games in alternation, so the same total amount of training. And finally, a no treatment control. These were given to in classrooms by the teachers for 4 months over the course of the school year. And the findings were of the study were kind of interesting, I think. Both the intuitive condition and the mixed condition showed equal levels of performance on the intuitive tasks, and both the mixed and the symbolic condition showed equal levels of performance on the symbolic tasks, suggesting that these two kinds of material can synergize with each other. They make sense to kids, and they can help them learn math. And we saw this both in the first 3 months after the intervention ended, but we also saw it a year later. So it looks like it's an enduring effect on their math skills. So we can ask now, okay, we've got math material, but being taught in a different way, does it produce, again, gender gap in India? Do you want to guess?
I think I know the answer.
Okay. It does not. Okay, engaging with math content produced equal benefits for girls and boys in this study. Now, I'll go on and give you two more slides that are going to make the same point, but not. This was in preschools. Once these findings were obtained, the Delhi government invited us into the regular elementary schools to present the mixed games to kindergartners and first graders, so we can look at what they did. This is a briefer capturing of what went on in the kindergarten classes when you look at all the measures on the left or all the symbolic or intuitive measures on the middle and on the right. They're not doing as well on the intuitive measures, but on the symbolic measures we're seeing pretty robust improvements for first graders, and again, no sex differences in performance, and the same thing happened for the kids in first grade. Okay, that raises the question, why are there no sex differences in the Indian children's learning from the math games? And here I have to give you a caveat. There are many factors that could explain this, including cultural differences in the children's families, differences in the way preschool experiences are organized in India versus the U.S. Here's a picture of an Indian preschool. Doesn't really look a lot like a U.S. or a French preschool, or differences in the school curricula. So there are many factors that could be playing a role. All I want to leave you with, though, is three suggestions that come from features of the ways in which the games, the math games, were played. First of all, in order to make it possible for teachers to have a whole class of 40 plus kids playing math games under their direction, they needed a way for individual children to fill the gaps in their own knowledge. They weren't going to be able to go around and simultaneously monitor all 40 kids in the classroom and figure out who had made a mistake and who had not. So they put posters on the walls and taught children how, if you're looking at, if you have a move to make in this game and you're not sure what the symbols mean and what move you should be making, here's how you can find out by consulting the poster, okay? And they did that both for number and for geometry. You can see the number poster on the photograph. And I think this may have had an unintended but important benefit in that by giving kids a way of determining when they did and didn't know the answer to a problem, and second of all, remedying it, I think this empowers children to take ownership of their own education, okay? And it may have had a positive effect in part for that reason. Second suggestion, the games were played socially with peers, 3 to 5 kids in a group, helping one another and competing against the other groups. And again, the rationale here was generally the levels of knowledge in a math class are heterogeneous. heterogeneous. But if you put kids in groups, then if one child doesn't know the answer to a problem, there may be other kids in the group that do, and if they help each other, then they'll be able to solve those problems. And I think likely that made the games both more fun and also allowed children to learn in their own social environment, because these are neighborhood-based schools. So when you're playing with a group of other kids in your class, they're probably also members of your own culture and your own social world. And then finally, the teachers played with the kids. And this, I think, may have allowed children to see the teachers as more socially engaging and therefore to motivate them to want to learn from them. So it raises the question for me, might it be the case that in France as well, if procedures like this, but appropriate to a French context, were introduced, would something happen to that gender gap? I would love to know. Okay, this is, I think, is my last slide. I want to end just by saying that learning at home and learning in school are very, very different enterprises, okay? Many of the things that you're expected to learn in school can't be seen. You can't directly time travel to the past and see historical events. You can't get inside a plant and see the processes that propel its growth and so forth, okay? This contrasts with cultural learning at home, where kids first learn who's in their social world, and then they look at them and follow them and attend to their actions and attempt to reproduce them. Second, some of the skills that children are expected to learn in school depend on combinatorial symbol systems that are relatively recent inventions over the scale of cognitive evolution. The brain isn't built to deal with these systems, and as research by Stan and others has shown, it can take a very, very long time to become a fluent reader, a fluent calculator, and so forth. And when you do, you see changes in the brain that reflect that. Third, in multicultural countries like India, but also France and the US, educational systems have a social goal. And the goal is to bridge cultural differences and create a community and a sense of identity with the country as a whole by not just splintering into different cultural groups, okay? Now, these are worthy goals, but they may encounter resistance, I think, from children's intrinsic dispositions for cultural learning. But I don't want to end on a pessimistic note, because I think an understanding of cognitive evolution actually suggests ways that can make formal education more effective. I think we know now that children learn new concepts best when their learning is supported by core knowledge, that they require extra support and practice when they have to master skills that aren't part of our evolutionary history, and that they're highly predisposed from infancy to learn from and about the people in their social world. So when one confronts a classroom that's composed of children coming from different cultures, special efforts may be needed in order to give them that sense of belongingness. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.